Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the cup and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but...
Yeah, we did. We started to burn way too many things we found. It's Harvey Wasserman back with you for another Solartopia Green Power Wellness Hour. We have a great guest to begin and a great guest at 5:30. We're going to start with David Swanson, one of the truly superb writers and activists fighting against war. David, you with us?
Hi, Harvey. How are you?
Well, what do you think about this statement, David? War is a lie. What do you think about that? You've got so much great writing. I've been honored to speak with you a number of times, and you are going to have a major conference in September that you have graciously asked me to speak at. And why don't you talk to us, give us a little bio of yourself, David. I couldn't begin to describe all you do. You've written God knows how many books, and you are, in my mind, one of the premier activists for peace on this planet. So tell us a bit about yourself, because I can't do you justice.
Well, back at you, Harvey. As always, I am now working, among other things, on a project called World Beyond War, and we are planning this big conference in September that you have agreed to speak at, which we're very much looking forward to, that is going to be looking at alternatives to war, what we could do instead of using war as a hammer for every nail and other problem out there in the world. And people can go to worldbeyondwar.org and see all the incredible speakers that will be there and actions being planned and what they can do to sign up and come or plan an event in their part of the world. And so that's one thing I work on. Another is rootsaction.org, which is a multi-issue progressive online activist group. But I also, as you mentioned, write books and give talks and write articles and give speeches and so forth. And my latest book is called War is a Lie, the second edition. It's a book from 5 years ago that I updated because we've had five more years of lies about wars and, to some extent, resistance to lies about wars, and looking at, you know, where the public is responding better and where we still have a lot of work to be done.
God, do we have a lot of work to be done, especially since we now have Mussolini and Margaret Thatcher running for the presidency. Oh, my God. So before we jump into it, I do want to recount an incident, and you probably read about this. Last week on the show, we did the first ever broadcast. I'm sure it was rough and crazy from the deck of the Golden Rule, the fabulous boat that sailed into or tried to sail into the Pacific nuclear test zone in 1958. The boat sank. It was revived, and we launched it last year. And I caught up with it in Portland, Oregon last week. And I was standing on the ship. We had our cell phones. We did our best to do a coherent hour. I listened to it. I don't know. It sounded like we were all having a great time, which we were, although it was pouring down rain. And then literally an hour after I hung up and the show ended, we were rammed. We were crashed into it by a police boat. There's a big debate about whether they actually purposely rammed it or it was accidental. But literally 2 or 3 feet below where I was standing on the deck, the sharp bow of a police boat from one of the counties around Portland put a hole in the Golden Rule. It was an astonishing event. People can look at my website, solartopia.org, and a few others, or reader-supported news about what I wrote about it. David, did you read about that? I mean, it was a truly amazing moment.
Well, I did, yes, but I hadn't heard if there had been any sort of apology or compensation or any resolution of that.
Well, the cops who did it, and I was looking right at the guy in the back, there were only two guys on the boat, I think they just completely mishandled the situation. The guy, they apologized profusely. Mimi German, who was on the boat with us, thought that they might have done it on purpose. And other people weren't so sure. So I think the damage was pretty minimal, actually. It's more or less cosmetic. The boat, the hole in the boat is about 5-6 feet above waterline. And it wasn't all that deep, but it was just an astonishing moment to feel the boat crunch in right below my feet. My goodness. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens eventually. But, yeah, it was, first of all, it was, and David, you should do this. I mean, it was just such a thing to be on the Golden Rule, you know, the original peace boat. You know, what happened to them was they sailed from San Diego, and Bonnie Raitt's father, the great singer Bonnie Raitt, her father, John Raitt, who was also a great singer, was at the launch. He's a Quaker, and Bonnie was raised a Quaker. And then they went to Honolulu, and they were going to sail into the test zone. And they were headed to the test zone, and they got arrested, thrown in jail in Honolulu. But another boat that was in touch with them in the harbor, called the renamed itself the Phoenix of Hiroshima. And they did sail into the test zone. And you'll be interested in this, David. I was just contacted by the granddaughter of the owners of the boat, that boat is also underwater, as was the Golden Rule, in a river in Northern California, this one near Sacramento, and it looks like it could be salvaged, and I'm hopefully, it might take a lot of money in a few years, but hopefully someday we'll see both the Golden Rule and the Phoenix of Hiroshima, you know, sailing to protest peace boats, which is something you would be perfectly appropriate to do. I think it's in the cards, David. One of these days you're going to be on both those boats. Let's put it that way.
Well, I'm planning on it. It's friends of ours, Vets for Peace, who are sailing the restored Golden Rule around, and they've got plans for years to come, and including making it over here to the eastern side of the United States. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, there's one event I want you to have on your radar screen, and Mimi, my friend who was on the boat and was on the radio show last week, is working on this. Every year, the fleet sends boats, they call Fleet Week, into the harbor in Portland, Oregon. And what we'd like to do is organize a Peace Fleet Week during the same period and get to have a kayaktivist convention and, you know, have a... people there with the Golden Rule, and hopefully eventually the Phoenix of Hiroshima, maybe a Greenpeace boat, and just to have a peace fleet to be there with the war fleet. That would be wild.
That sounds good, yeah.
Yeah, so let's put that on the radar screen, and we can start working on it. They do get some funding, we think, from the city of Portland. Mimi is tracking it down. And we'll keep you posted on that, and this radio show will be following it, and maybe next year we'll do another show from the deck of the Golden Rule, and maybe it won't be raining, and maybe we'll be a little more coherent, but hopefully you'll be on with us.
Yeah, well, maybe equal funding for mass murder and for peace would be a step in the right direction for the
city. What a concept. So, David Swanson, tell us about your most recent book and what's involved with it and what you're working on to further the cause of peace.
Well, I'm looking at how we're misled about war, and I'm going around the country and I'm talking about, you know, the examples from centuries past and decades past of countless wars, but also about what's in the news at the moment. So here we are being told, you know, all sorts of stories about why someone would go and shoot up a nightclub in Orlando, and this is the only thing in the news. And I'm being sent graphics showing me that, you know, more people in the United States have died from gun violence since 1968 than have died in U.S. wars ever, including all U.S. wars. But, of course, that leaves out millions and millions of non-Americans dying in U.S. wars, even in just recent decades. And we are given all these reasons why, you know, someone may have done this horrendous act, and buried down in the bottom of stories that, you know, that have completely unrelated headlines, we discover that this, that, you know, in addition to all sorts of other complex motives, no doubt, this guy had the same reason that every single foreign terrorist in the United States in recent decades has expressed, every single one. I don't know of any exceptions, and that includes, you know, foreign terrorist organizations that have claimed credit for things or been blamed for things. It includes all sorts of poor suckers set up and framed by the FBI. But he says, he witnesses say that he said, and he said on a call to 9/11, to 911, and he wrote on Facebook, you know, that his motivation was revenge for the United States bombing his country, and revenge for the United States bombing ISIS. You know, it's not clear whether those are the same things, whether he thought of his country as Afghanistan or Syria. It could have been any of a dozen countries that the United States is now bombing. But this was the explanation, which of course doesn't justify anything, but if every single terrorist was saying, "I'm doing this, you know, because of the Martians," you know, we would at least look into why they were all saying something so crazy. But they're all saying something very believable. We are all doing this because you're bombing women and children and innocent people. You know, of course, the last thing ISIS wants is for the United States to stop the bombing, because it empowers ISIS to recruit more killers like this guy. But you know, he says you must stop bombing the Islamic State. This is his motivation. And the best response you get, the best response out of liberals in the United States is, let's ban guns, or let's ban assault rifles, or let's have an extra check on certain people before they can get an assault rifle, or, you know, or something even more minimal than that. But these same politicians who will stay up all night talking and act as if they want to limit, you know, gun sales in the United States are flooding the world with these weapons, and the ISIS videos from Syria and Iraq have U.S. guns and U.S. Humvees and U.S. weapons of all sorts. The United States is far and away the top supplier of weaponry to the Middle East, to poor countries, to dictatorships, to countries in the entire world taken as a whole. It is the arms dealer to the world. And we've started to at least talk about what sense it would make to limit gun sales domestically. Why that has to stop at the water's edge and evaporate into, you know, ignorance and apathy and just acceptance of, you know, because it's $65 million a year from the war profiteers on lobbyists. And when the NRA spends $3 million, we're outraged. We're offended. It's corruption, you know. Well, it's the same corruption, just on a much grander scale. And we haven't seem to find our way clear to even talk about it.
Well, David, are you saying that it would not be a proper response to the killings in Orlando to spend $1 trillion on nuclear weapons? I mean, is that what you're trying to say here?
Well, yeah. I mean, what the NRA counts on, what Lockheed Martin counts on, what the media outlets count on, it is that the United States will address all problems by just doing more of what created the problem in the first place, right? To the point where there was a reporter on NPR a couple days ago who falsely reported that when there was a terrorist incident in Spain, the Spanish people turned around and elected a right-wing government. Well, absolutely false. When there was a terrorist incident in Spain, the Spanish people very clearly and explicitly recognized that it was blowback for Spain's participation in a U.S. war on Iraq, immediately elected a leftist government, and pulled Spanish troops out of Iraq, and there hasn't been a terrorist attack in Spain since. So there's a number of lessons to be learned there, which NPR simply lied about until Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting went after them, and then they, you know, corrected their mistake without explaining what had actually happened. So that there's this thinking in the United States that's just so pervasive that you must not know. You must not be aware of blowback. You must not recognize. It must remain a secret why each and every terrorist does what they do, even though each and every one of them gives the same rationale. That the assumption is that, well, now the United States must elect Donald Trump. Which is based on another falsehood, which is that Donald Trump is the greater of the warmongers in the race for the White House. But just the level of ignorance and acceptance that a policy based on pragmatic consideration of results is just impossible. That we must act either based on financial corruption or on ignorant emotion. I mean, this is the universal understanding now in the United States of how our government must function. When we know that a global war on terrorism produces more terrorism, it does it every year, and yet we're supposed to just continue that. You know, we know that what the United States does in so many areas of public policy is counterproductive, but nobody stops and asks, is mass incarceration producing more criminals or fewer criminals? Because nobody imagines that the result would be acted on. You know, that we have a government that gives a damn, you know, whether its policies are having good results or not. And so we blunder along when, you know, we know that after there was a shooting in Australia that was less murderous than Orlando, Australia banned guns. And now it costs more to get a hold of a gun in Australia than you could rob from any house in Australia. And there hasn't been a mass killing in Australia other than Australia's participation in U.S. wars since. And we know this. We know how Norway responded to a terrorist incident with sanity and pragmatic actions. And yet there's just not even an inkling of suspicion that the United States, you know, could act on that information.
I'm talking with David Swanson here. David, I got to ask you a really dumb question since we have you for so little time and you're such a wealth of knowledge. And this is a question, of course, on everybody's mind. What can individual Americans do to end war?
Well, they can educate each other. They can go to worldbeyondwar.org and sign up with us and click what types of actions they want to be part of, what sort of actions they like doing, and get involved with others doing them. They can spread around good media outlets like this one and unsubscribe from the New York Times. They can work on getting better information into history books in schools, better speakers into schools, better guests on talk shows, use our PowerPoints and books and speakers to do events, and they can push back against particular efforts of war making. They can also organize for actual conversion from war to peace industries at the local level, state level, federal level. We're glad to help and advise. They can stop paying their taxes and make clear why. There are risks involved there, and you should be aware of what you're doing, but many are doing it that can, you know, very gladly advise others how to as well. You know, we can recognize that the war machine is more corrupt and more heavily funded than ever and very, very far from invincible. And that in 2013, public outrage, based on 10 years of public outrage over Iraq, stopped the bombing of Syria that was going to be a massive bombing campaign. That in 2015, we were presented with a choice between war on Iran or a nuclear agreement with Iran, and public pressure was key to upholding the nuclear agreement as the preferable alternative. So we can recognize that when we get a choice between war and peace, we often choose peace, and but we have to find the means to communicate to each other and answer the question correctly when nobody asks the question, when they just go ahead with wars. The current president has bragged about bombing 7 countries. The United States has 7 serious wars going on right now with ground troops in 5 of them, and nobody I talk to can even name them, right? So get aware of what's going on and start working with the belief that we can stop each of these wars on stopping them. It doesn't take that many people. You know, the effort in 2013 that was unprecedented that stopped a missile attack on Syria was a tiny, teeny, tiny fraction of the U.S. public. So, you know, we can make these things happen, but don't get distracted by presidential election circuses.
David, do me a favor then. Can you name the seven wars in the five countries we have troops in for our listeners?
Well, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Libya. And of those, the U.S. has ground troops. They're called special forces. They're very, very special, don't you know? But they're, you know, bigger than most countries' entire military. MS special forces are in most nations on Earth, literally. But there are significant U.S. ground troops, boots on the ground, as we were promised would never happen so many, many times. Now, back in Libya, in Syria and Iraq, still in Afghanistan, Iraq,
how about Yemen?
And Syria.
Troops in Yemen?
Sorry. In Yemen, the U.S. military is actively engaged in bombing Yemen along with the Saudi military. And, of course, Secretary of State Clinton took $10 million from Saudi Arabia into her family foundation and $900,000 from Boeing and got those airplanes over there to Saudi Arabia that are bombing Yemen, building up the power of al-Qaeda in Yemen, completely counterproductive in that regard, never mind murderous, never mind criminal. I mean, each of these wars is also criminal. There is not legal in any sense. And they are counterproductive, and they are murderous, and they are environmentally destructive, and they are economically costly. And I think you know, there is huge potential in each of those places for escalation, and there is a war budget set to run out around April. So, you know, much will depend on what happens in the next U.S. regime. But I think, you know, dumping your energy and time and money into, you know, this brutal warmonger or that one is not going to be as useful in the coming months as building a movement that changes U.S. culture so that continuing down this path is unacceptable, whatever individual is in the White House.
God, you know, it's just mind-boggling to me. Barack Obama, who campaigned saying he was going to get rid of nuclear weapons, that was a big part of his shtick, is now talking about spending $1 trillion to update the whatever update means, our nuclear weapons arsenal.
Well, I mean, remember, you know, that Barack Obama went and gave a pretty speech in which he tried to convince everyone that it would take decades, probably not his lifetime, to get rid of nuclear weapons, and then years later gave another similar speech in Hiroshima, where, you know, he not only presented the false history about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but maintained that war has always been with us since the rising of the first man and is necessary to defend against evil, and probably we can't do anything in my lifetime, and so forth. And people applaud that crap and act as if it's something good or useful, while he's eliminated fewer nukes than any previous president as long as there have been nukes, while he's putting, as you say, $1 trillion in the coming years into new nukes, building smaller so-called more usable nukes, putting more nukes into Europe, putting so-called missile defense bases into Romania and under construction in Poland. Now a proposal out for a new so-called missile defense base in either New York or I'm forgetting one other state, or Ohio, you may be aware of. They're going to pick one of these three states, unless we convince them to pick none, to put one of these disastrous boondoggle missile sites in. I mean, this is a new Cold War. This is a new nuclear age. This is the leadership of Barack Obama, and people excuse him for it in a way that they never would. George W. Bush or any previous president, who, by the way, eliminated more nukes than Barack Obama.
God, that's amazing. We're talking with David Swanson, World Without War. When's your conference coming up, and how can people get a hold of you, David?
Yeah, the key word is beyond there, World Beyond War, and the website is worldbeyondwar.org. It's the week of the International Day of Peace in September, September 23rd to 25th, and then a nonviolent action planned for Monday the 26th, all in Washington, D.C. But we will have simultaneous events with great speakers and actions around the world and the country, and a conference in Berlin, Germany, where U.S. whistleblowers and former participants in the drone murder program will be presenting a big petition to the German government pushing for the closure of Ramstein Air Base. And we're planning a conference in Ireland, and we're eager to help anyone who's too far to get to Washington, D.C., to plan an event where they are.
Well, you know, it occurs to me that the extant phrase for all that with the military is that war is a racket. It was coined by Smedley Butler back in the 20s, or 30s, actually, 20s and 30s. And it's just like the drug war. The drug war is a racket. I mean, they never, and even John Ehrlichman has been quoted now as saying, the former Nixon aide, that they really knew that marijuana wasn't a problem. They just wanted to put black and young people in jail. And that, we don't have a national security problem in this country, except that, you know, the war industry needs more money spent on it. Would you agree?
That's exactly right, and they're quite open about it. There was an article in the Politico, a Capitol Hill newspaper, a few weeks back where senior Pentagon officials, albeit anonymously, were just openly saying that all this pretense of a bigger Russian military threat is all nonsense, just as it was for decades. And what's the driving force here is the Army's desire for a reason to exist and profits, the incredible profits to be made. And this is, you know, this is why the NATO and European Union expansion up to Russia's border that now has Britain threatening to pull out of the EU, Russia threatening European nations if they continue collaborating with what they see as illegal U.S. aggression and violation of treaties, and the U.S. having pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia. This is, you know, driven by the incredible profits to be made, even if it results in nuclear war. I mean, this is a form of madness, and it's not so much that the U.S. public doesn't care as that the U.S. public hasn't bothered to know what's going on.
Well, there's also a concerted effort to make the U.S. public think that they can't do anything. And, you know, another time we can talk about election theft and all the stuff. This primary season in our politics was just absolutely outrageous in terms of
Indeed.
The disenfranchisement of millions of people, ending in a California where there's still 3 million or so votes that haven't been counted despite declaring Hillary Clinton the winner. I mean, it's mind-boggling, David. We have so much work to do. But you are at it all the time. It's really, it's important that people know who you are and what you do. Where can they get a hold of you again?
Well, same to you, Harvey, and I hope they do count those ballots in California someday. I'm at davidswanson.org, I guess, is the easiest place.
All right, buddy. Well, listen, I know you got to go. You will be back with us many times. Let's follow this. Let's do this Peace Fleet Week thing in Portland, Oregon, next year. It will be spectacular.
Yeah.
I look forward to sailing the Golden Rule and the Phoenix of Hiroshima and doing a show with you from both boats. So, David, we'll have you back, and I'll certainly see you in September. Okay, buddy?
Great idea. Look forward to that Fleet Week.
All right, we'll let you go. Talk to you soon.
Okay,
David Swanson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, David. Thank you, Crew in New York, for having you on with us. We have spent the last half hour talking about peace with one of our great advocates and writers, David Swanson, a terrific speaker if you ever get a chance to hear David. We're going to switch gears slightly now to a related issue, certainly related to war. War, as David deals with it primarily, has to do with nations between nations. Uh-oh. Are we okay there? Linda Seeley, are you with us?
I am.
Okay, okay, good. So I guess I was David hanging up. So we're going to switch gears a little bit now. In the second half hour of the show, we're going to go on with the great Linda Seeley, who's been with us before, talking to us from San Luis Obispo, California, about a nuclear power plant that is waging war on the planet and on the future of all human life. Linda, welcome to the show.
I'm Harvey. Thank you. I'm really, really happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you, and you are always brilliant and wonderful and a great human being to boot. So tell us at the top of the half hour here your organization, what you do, and what you're about here in terms of Diablo Canyon.
Okay. I'm with the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, and we've been the legal intervener against the Diablo Canyon plant since since before it opened, since 1973. And we've taken the NRC to court many a time. We've our presence has made sure that Diablo Canyon is safer than it would have been. It's not safe. And we're continuing through the years to try to get this plant shut down with its two huge reactors that are destroying the ocean life and pumping heat into the atmosphere, spreading radiation all over California, and built on a big network of active earthquake faults. In fact, there's four active earthquake faults right in the vicinity of Diablo Canyon, within 3 or 4 miles.
And so Diablo Canyon is two very large commercial atomic reactors. They opened in the mid-'80s. They are the last remaining commercial atomic reactors in California, for the record. We recently, grassroots action recently shut two at San Onofre between L.A. and San Diego. In 1989, people in Sacramento voted to shut the Rancho Seco reactor near Sacramento. And we also shut the Humboldt reactor, which was directly, still is, as a matter of fact, directly on top of an earthquake fault, and then major proposed reactor construction projects were defeated by citizen action at Bodega and at Bakersfield. So there are these two giant reactors remaining in San Luis Obispo, California, Diablo Canyon, and I got to tell you, since October 2012, October 2014, a dozen reactors in the United States have shut or been or have announced shutdowns, including one yesterday, the Fort Calhoun reactor in Nebraska. The board of the Omaha Public Power District announced that they will shut Fort Calhoun this year. So it's going to go down quick. And we have three reactors in Illinois, and another one at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, shutdowns announced within the last month. So this is an industry in accelerated collapse. And it becomes dangerous, especially dangerous because these old reactors, their owners, as the economic situation falls apart, are less willing than ever, not that they were generous with it in the first place, of putting money into safety and maintenance. And so I'm more nervous now about our commercial reactors than ever. And two of the very worst are these two in Diablo Canyon, California. Now, an exception to the general rule on shutting nukes is that at Diablo Canyon, and Linda, I'm going to ask you to explain this, we have state options to shut these two reactors. Usually, most of the critical issues are preempted by the feds because of the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. But we have coming up on June 28th a state hearing that could actually prompt the shutdown of these two reactors. Linda Seeley and San Luis Obispo, can you tell us about this?
Yes. We are very excited about this meeting that's happening on June 28th, and I would ask any of your listeners, Harvey, who live in California, who live anywhere close to San Luis Obispo, or even who live far away, to come to this meeting. It's 2 weeks from this past Tuesday, June 28th, A rally starts at 9 a.m., and the meeting itself starts at 10 a.m., and it is the State Lands Commission, which is kind of an obscure little commission composed of only three people. The three people who are on it are Gavin Newsom, who is our lieutenant governor, Betty Yee, who is the state comptroller, and then a fellow named Michael Cohen, who is a financial person.
He's the, I had to look that up earlier, Linda. He's the state's chief financial officer.
Chief what?
Financial officer.
Financial officer, right, yeah. He's a very ethical person. And what has happened is that long, long ago, this power plant has been a thorn in our side for a long time. In 1969 and 70, or 68 and 69, I guess it was, the PG&E leased what are called the tidelands. The tidelands are public. They're owned by the public. All of the coastline in California is owned by the public. And so Diablo Canyon got leases, one for Unit 1, one for Unit 2, for these tidelands upon which the reactors sit. And and these two leases are set to expire in 2018 and 2019. Now, Gavin Newsom, about 2 months ago, when this issue first came up into the forefront, said, you know, every large development along the coastline is required by law to have, under the California Environmental Quality Act, which was put into effect after these two plants got their leases, but under the California Environmental Quality Act, which we call CEQA, the environmental impacts of these projects have to be assessed, and it has to be weighed whether or not the benefit that is accrued through the operation of the plants outweighs the environmental harm that's done. Now,
Can I interrupt you very quickly? I have a quick trivia question for you. Who signed the California Environmental Quality Act into law?
That was Ronald Reagan.
I love that. Reagan signed
it. I love it.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Great. I hope
he's twirling in his grave.
Yeah, well, maybe he isn't, Harvey, because he did love California, and he wouldn't want to see it go up in a radioactive cloud, right?
No, and his ranch is right downwind from Diablo Canyon.
That's right.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I couldn't resist.
Yeah, that's okay. He'd be on our side. So anyway, the environmental impacts of this monstrosity are too many to name. If I started right now, I wouldn't be finished by tomorrow morning. What's going to happen, God willing, at this state meeting is that the staff is going to recommend that there be a full CEQA review and an environmental impact report prepared. Now, it takes a long time to prepare an EIR. Environmental impact report. They'll probably have a public comment period of around 60 to 180 days, but I can't remember. I don't know how many it will be, where people are allowed to submit their comments about what they think are the environmental impacts of this. Not only people, but organizations will be doing that too. The Sierra Club, the Friends of the Earth, the Center for Biological Diversity, the Audubon, the Surf Rider, all kinds of groups will be submitting comments on, because what they do at this plant is they suck in 2.5 billion gallons of water every single 24 hours, superheat it, pass it through to cool the nuclear reaction, if they didn't have that water coming through there, the whole thing would blow up in a matter of hours. So they have to constantly keep this cold water circulating through there. But when it goes out of the plant, when it's discharged back into the ocean, it's 20 degrees hotter than it was when it came in, plus every form of life that has been sucked up in there is dead. And so it's responsible for killing billions and billions of aquatic life every single year. In fact, Diablo Canyon is the number one cause of the loss of aquatic life in the whole state of California. They also have a large desalination plant there that's never had an EIR done. And that thing dumps mercury, lead, cadmium, all kinds of toxic chemicals right back into the ocean, and no EIR has ever been done for that. They are allowed to release batch releases of all kinds of radioactive materials, both into the air, into the ocean, and it leaks out into the water or the earth underneath too, because remember, Harvey, that radioactive particles are really active, and they're really tiny, like tritium. Radioactive tritium is such a tiny molecule. It's hydrogen, and hydrogen is the very smallest, the first element in the table of elements, and so it's impossible to keep it sequestered. So it's out in there in the water where people are surfing, and it's poison.
A nightmare.
It is
a nightmare.
Unnecessary. What? It's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare.
Right? And so we don't need it.
Right, we don't need it. And there's really, I guess realistically you would say that there's really no way that Diablo Canyon can pass CEQA standards at this point. And PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, which owns Diablo, they must know that. So what are we predicting? If the State Lands Commission votes to require that for a renewal of the lease, PG&E and Diablo meet CEQA standards, what would we expect to happen?
Well, it won't be able to. I mean, it can't pass muster. And it has to, remember, the benefits have to outweigh the detriments of it. And the fact is that Diablo Canyon right now gives us about 8.6% of the electricity in California. And it also, because it's pumping out 24/7, pumping out this electricity into the grid every day, it impedes the use of solar and other renewables, because they can't, with a nuclear power plant, if they, a lot of days when it's a sunny day, like today is a sunny, windy day in California, they have more than enough sun and wind to power the grid right now. But they can't do it because Diablo Canyon is pushing out into the grid its base load into that grid. And so what they have to do, because the grid can only hold so much power, they have to cut down, they have to turn off the solar, they have to turn off the wind, and allow Diablo to keep on operating. It's an antiquated 19th or 20th century technology, I'll give it that much credit.
The reality is that gas, unfortunately, fracked gas, which we don't like, but solar and wind are much, 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 much cheaper now than operating even a nuclear reactor that has been amortized. Is that right?
That's right. It's and the other thing you have to remember, Harvey, is that the Public Utility Commission is probably going to order PG&E to build cooling towers at Diablo Canyon if it passes muster with the State Lands Commission. And what that means is that this once-through cooling debacle with the loss of all of the aquatic life, will have to change, because there's an order in California that all once through cooling facilities have to shut down. So if they do, if PG&E is forced to build the cooling towers, the cheapest it could go is probably about $3 billion, and estimates have been up to $14 billion for how much it would cost to build the cooling towers. So if the Public Utility Commission orders them to build the cooling towers, then that PG&E will argue that they need to pass that cost back on to us, the consumers, and, you know, write that into our rates, which will increase the cost of electricity at Diablo Canyon, you know, by a lot. And then there are all the other upgrades that they have to do in order to complete, because they have applied to go on with this plant for another 20 years after the license, the federal licenses expire. Those federal licenses expire in 2024 and 2025. But PG&E, way back in 2009, applied to run the plant for an additional 20 years beyond its initial life expectancy. Now, that's like putting a 1968 Volkswagen on life support and expecting it to, run on the Autobahn.
I'd say it's more like a Pinto or a Corvair. We're talking with Linda Seeley from the San Luis Obispo, California. Mothers for Peace. What's your website, Linda?
Mothersforpeace.org.
And we are looking at June 28th, 10 a.m., a major, major hearing in the state of California, the California Lands Commission, to decide whether or not to extend leases for the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor that were issued in the late 60s, whether to renew these leases with or without the requirement that the plant owners meet the standards set out in 1970. But these are 46-year-old environmental standards, and they're signed into law by Ronald Reagan, for God's sakes. And, of course, Pacific Gas Electric is arguing that they're grandfathered and they shouldn't have to meet these standards. I mean, what a chutzpah. 46-year-old environmental standards that they don't want to meet. And now the question I have, Linda, is, Linda Seeley, if CEQA is required and PG&E does jump into the EIR, the Environmental Impact Review process, this could take years that they could continue to operate the reactors. Is that right?
Well, it probably would take a year and a half, 2 years for the entire process, because they do have deadlines on everything, and it has to end. And PG&E, they will definitely contribute, but there will be an outside independent analysis done of the benefits and detriments of the plant. So it won't be PG&E won't be allowed to paint its own rosy picture of this. But I wanted to tell you about something else, Harvey, that is really fascinating and not that troubling, but it's an indicator, I think, for us about what we're up against here.
Go ahead, please.
Well, it's about there is a lot of organization going on around here to save Diablo Canyon. It's being done there was a film a few years ago called Pandora's Promise, a pro-nuclear film that was produced.
Well, Linda Seeley, I actually like Pandora's Promise because it starts off with Helen Caldicott, and they show her, and they try and make her look bad, although I should think she looks fine. And then the second person on the screen is me, and they put me on because I'm giving a speech in New York, in Manhattan, and I start, and I ask for permission to use the F word. And then I proceeded to say a four-letter F word, but it's not on screen, and they, because obviously they didn't want to use that word, and they put it in there to make me look bad. But of course, as we all know, when it comes to nuclear power, the F word is Fukushima. And so the rest of the film was unwatchable. So I'm a big fan of Pandora's Promise. But anyway, I do want to ask, I do have one question I want to get before you go further with this.
Okay.
EIR is required by the Lands Commission to renew the lease, who pays to do the EIR? Who does it?
Well, that's a good question. I do know the answer to that. The applicant would be PG&E. And I don't know if they'd ask to have that passed on to the ratepayers or not. They probably would, because they pass everything on to the ratepayers. So, that's every time an applicant applies for a project.
Well,
this is a project.
They have to pay for it. Does PG&E actually do the EIR, or do they pay money and then an independent agency does it?
Yeah, an independent agency does it. Actually, our county would be very, very involved in it, our county planning commission.
Is that a good thing?
Maybe yes, maybe no. It would be a challenge for them. And there may be a state agent. There's probably a state entity that would review it, too, because these are state lands. But that it also involves the county. But it's so political, Harvey. It's hard to say.
Right.
Hard to say.
PG&E would have to. How many millions of dollars do you think it would cost to do the environmental impact review at Diablo Canyon?
Oh man, a lot of millions. I don't know how many, because that's a very complex project, and there are so many different components. Plus, there is also the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, which is another group that is working to shut down Diablo. They are contending that not only should the tidelands be considered in this EIR, but the entire land. PG&E owns 9,000 acres out there. And they say that because of the public trust doctrine, that the entire project should be reviewed. Then that would include the dry cask storage. It would include the transmission lines. It would include a lot more than just the tidelands part. And so if they're successful in getting that incorporated into the EIR, that would make it even more complex. Plus, there are people right now who are saying, this is I'll put it this way. Reliable sources are saying that, that number one, the health impacts, first of all, San Luis Obispo County went before Diablo Canyon opened. It had a very low incidence of cancer. Now Diablo Canyon, or San Luis Obispo County, has a very high incidence of cancer. And it's a few different types that are skyrocketing. We have the highest incidence in the state of melanoma. We also have a high incidence of childhood leukemia, thyroid cancer, and breast cancer. And we have a very high rate of miscarriage and very low birth weight infants here. And all of those health effects are directly caused by radiation. All of those cancers are radiation caused. Now, we know that we cannot separate them out. We know we can't say, oh, you live near Diablo Canyon. Your child got leukemia that was caused by Diablo Canyon, because there are so many other variables. However, these things may be able to be considered in the EIR.
That would be devastating.
Yes.
That would be a deal. We're close to being out of time, Linda, so Linda Seeley from San Francisco Mothers for Peace, tell us what's coming up exactly? How can people participate and get to your website for further information?
Okay. So go to our website, mothersforpeace.org. And there's another meeting I want to tell you about that's really fascinating, too, Harvey. That's coming up on June 21st in the 5 p.m. And it's in Avila Beach. You can go to our website to check that out. It's the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. That meets regularly here. Every 4 months they meet here. However, this meeting is going to be especially interesting because a geologist named Robert Sewell, who was hired by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do an analysis of the potential for a tsunami around Diablo Canyon, he wrote his report, he did his analysis, and submitted it to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they held it back from public scrutiny for 10 years. He did it He did it in 2004. And finally, with a request for, what's that called, you know, to get records?
A public document request?
Yeah.
A Freedom of Information.
Freedom of Information Act. Yeah. Request. Finally, we got a copy of it, and it was totally blacked out. But then finally, the Independent Safety Committee got a hold of a copy of it. And Robert Sewell is going to be there at this meeting this coming on the 21st, this coming whenever that is, Tuesday, I believe. He is going to talk about his report. And this is going to be the first time that any of us have been able to hear about this tsunami report. And what he says in the report is that there is not an insignificant likelihood that because of the geology under the water around Diablo Canyon, that if there were an earthquake, it could easily cause an underwater landslide. And if there is an underwater landslide, that creates a localized tsunami. And that could be absolutely devastating for those, it would be the cooling system.
Oh, my God. Linda, we're out of time. You finished just on time. Thank you so much for New York. Linda Steele and San Luis Obispo. We'll be back. We'll have you back. We'll talk next week about this Diablo situation again. See you next week. And a nuclear-free, war-free world.
Now we're going to have a solar utopia.